Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me this time is host Liz Riegel.
Hey, how's it going?
Liz, could you say a little bit about yourself?
I am a grant writer, and I've always been like a huge English nerd, but I actually don't have a ton of experience with poetry specifically, so I was interested to do this episode because I really liked one of these poems when I read it in high school, but the other one I had no experience with. But I've wanted to be on this podcast for a while because, I don't know, I'm just a big nerd about it.
Well, I'm glad to have you on. This time we are turning again to poetry, which I assume means that half of you are going to turn this off and skip ahead to the latest My Brother and Me episode.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, John.
This is an interesting topic for me, and probably not for a lot of people. We're doing the topic of metaphysical poetry, and the reason it's interesting to me is I have very strong memories of being taught this in high school. We had a textbook called Adventures in English Literature back in 1983 or whenever, and it had a picture of a fox hunter on the front. And I remember we were given this short course in metaphysical poetry, and I was fascinated by the idea of this school that wasn't really a school, that was sort of like an idea that came about later, and whether or not you really could do that, whether it's fair to group people together who didn't necessarily meet or didn't necessarily think that they were part of a movement. I also really liked the idea of a conceit. I remember being taught of what a conceit was and thought, oh, that's so neat.
So I had learned valediction, but I learned it in an English class in 11th and 12th grade, I had two different English teachers who had totally opposite perspectives on like the death of the author. And we did this one in 12th grade. And in 12th grade, we basically would learn, like we did, Dr. Zhivago without really learning anything about the Russian Revolution or the context behind it, and just sort of treating it as its own text, which I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of that approach. And so when we read this poem, we just read it as a poem without learning like the historical context really, and learned it in a unit where we were doing a bunch of other sort of randomly selected poetry. So the whole thing about conceits, I looked that up in preparation for this podcast episode. But I also really loved the concept. And I mean, it's obviously very like apparent in both of these poems. My first experience of this poem was just like in and of itself, like treating it as its own text.
I find it fascinating to try and teach this kind of poem outside of context. You know, I know about various theoretical approaches and the attempts to divorce the text from context. And I just don't know how you can start with a poem like this, because these two poems are 17th century poems. This is right after Queen Elizabeth and right before and during the English Civil War. It's not quite clear when To His Coy Mistress was written. Some people think it was written during the interregnum, which is the time when the monarchy was deposed. Valediction was a little bit earlier. So this was a time of great political upheaval. And it's funny because both of these are ostensibly love poems, but they're also poems that come about as a lot of things are happening in England. For one thing, printing is becoming very common. And so the dissemination of short secular poems is possible, whereas before poetry was really a courtly thing. To have a book of poems, you had to have it copied out by hand. It tended towards highly religious or highly political treaties. And this is kind of light and personal. There was a time when there weren't really love poems.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can only assume that there were love songs and, like, popular things, but they might not have been written down, and I'm sure they weren't treated with the same level of... When I was doing the background reading on this, the first thing I saw was that at the time these poems were sort of considered to be a little bit dumb and fluffy. Well, not dumb, but sort of not as, you know, refined and good of metaphors as previous, like, more sort of exalted poets.
The term metaphysical poetry is actually one that was invented in the 18th century by Samuel Johnson. It's sort of like the way impressionism for painting was really a dig at first by the critics. This was kind of a dig at these poems because Johnson thought that on the one hand, they were obsessed with religious ideas, and on the other hand, they were constantly pushing together disparate ideas. A conceit, which we've talked about here, is a metaphor that is strained or between two things that don't seem very much like each other.
Can I read this one quote from him? Because I thought that really summed it up, and I was surprised that this was considered a negative thing. So he said, "The most heterogeneous ideas are yoked by violence together. Nature and art are ransacked for illustrations, comparisons, and allusions." Which is cool. But apparently that was considered to be sort of an unrefined way of going about this.
Part of what's happening at this time is poetry is moving from its position in plays and in long narrative works and becoming more conversational. Mm. And that keeps moving and continuing into the 19th century. And this movement was seen by some 19th century critics as a kind of a misstep because it seemed to be artificial in a different way. These poems, just they moved from iambic pentameter to iambic tetrameter, which means that they just dropped one foot, and that changes the feel of them enormously. And when you compare this to like reading a Shakespeare sonnet or something like that, these are much more conversational and breezy. Maybe it's also because the words that are used are much closer to the words we use today.
And I think it's just because, like, any individual line of one of these poems in tetrameter, like, it could be something that a person would say, like, by accident, essentially, not realizing that it was metered. And when you get into, like, pentameter, then it's, like, no one would accidentally say a line of iambic pentameter. That's right. I really like meter in poetry, and it that's one of the reasons that I have a hard time sometimes getting into modern poetry. I took a bunch of Latin when I was in high school, and all Latin poetry is metered because that you can't really rhyme it. And we learned all the different, like, spondees and troches and, like, different, you know, kinds of meter. And I really, really like reading a poem and, like, sort of feeling out the meter of it and the rhythm that it gives to it. And I find that, like, really sort of sucks me into what's going on in the poem more than, you know, rhymes.
Let's start with the earlier of the two poems. This is John Donne's A Valediction for Bidding Morning, which was written probably in 1611 or 1612, and it was actually written for his wife on the occasion of a long journey he was about to take to the European continent. So let's listen to A Valediction for Bidding Morning.
As virtuous men pass mildly away and whisper to their souls to go, whilst some of their sad friends do say, "The breath goes now," and some say, "No." So let us melt and make no noise, no tear floods nor sigh tempests move. 'Twere profanation of our joys to tell the laity our love. Moving of the earth brings harms and fears. Men reckon what it did and meant, but trepidation of the spheres, though greater far, is innocent. Dull sublunary lover's love, whose soul is sense, cannot admit absence, because it doth remove those things which elemented it. But we by a love so much refined that ourselves know not what it is, interassured of the mind, care less eyes, lips, and hands to miss. Our two souls, therefore, which are one, though I must go, endure not yet a breach, but an expansion, like gold to airy thinness beat. If they be two, they are two so as stiff twin compasses are two. Thy soul, the fixed foot, makes no show to move, but doth if the other do. And though it in the center sit, yet when the other far doth roam, it leans and hearkens after it, and grows erect as that comes home. Such wilt thou be to me who must, like the other foot, obliquely run. Thy firmness makes my circle just, and makes me end where I begun.
So when we studied this, the first thing I remember was that everybody had to read it about a half a dozen times before they even understood what was going on in it. Because the language was sort of archaic, but also because, you know, he's using these conceits which kind of go off in a couple different directions. Like, the first part of it is, let's be in love like an old man dies. You know, it just sort of goes in a couple of weird directions. And then there were a lot of people in our class, and this is one of the problems with this whole death of the author, whatever you bring to this is valid thing, is a bunch of people didn't know what a drawing compass was. And so they were trying to make this very lengthy metaphor work with like a magnetic compass. And obviously it makes no sense. And I think some people even got to the point of writing their papers on this without having put that together. But so, not everybody in my class was a big fan of this poem, but I liked it a lot. I really thought that this metaphor was kind of beautiful, and I liked how it was straight. Like, I didn't have that sort of background of even what a conceit is and, like, the fact that it was controversial at the time, but I just really liked how it takes you down this long path. It really makes you visualize. Like, I was talking to somebody about this last night, like, oh, I'm about to record this podcast about this poem, and I found myself, like, doing two compass feet with my fingers, like, on a table to illustrate it. I don't know, this part of this poem especially has always stuck with me.
You mentioned it starts with comparing lovers parting to virtuous men dying, mm-hmm. and the idea that to be truly virtuous, you just kind of quietly accept your fate and expire without making a big fuss out of it.
Yeah, to the point where your friends aren't even sure if you're dead or not.
It's a weird conceit because it's comparing love with death, but it's also comparing it to a death that nobody actually has. Most people have very painful or distressing deaths, but this idea that, oh, you just sigh and you're gone.
Mm-hmm. I guess the unspoken comparison is like, oh, if they were to be sort of lame, worldly people, they would be wailing and screaming about how they have to leave each other, and I guess that would be like a guy dying painfully from being stabbed.
Now, Donne was a clergy member in the Church of England, and a lot of people know of his meditations. There's the famous meditation that has the line about, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee, the no man is an island meditation. And so there's a tendency to see him as a very bookish, clerical figure. But when I was reading about this, he actually started out life as kind of a wastrel. He was a womanizer and a spendthrift, and he was forced to become a member of the clergy. He did eventually settle down and fall in love with his wife. Her name was Anne. So this is there is something kind of touching about this, in that in this poem I think you can really see into an actual relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels very, very authentic.
It's like extremely sincere, because this isn't like when we get to the other poem. I know you had mentioned that, oh, it's been criticized sometimes for being just sort of it's very like, oh, I want you so bad, baby, essentially. and this one is very, you know, not intellectual exactly, but it's like the whole point of it is, we love each other so much that it doesn't matter whether we're next to each other or not. And that's, you know, not something you necessarily see as often.
the stakes are very high here, and this is one of the reasons why I think it's important to actually provide context mm-hmm. here. When you traveled in the 17th century, especially if you traveled by sea, there was no assurance you were ever coming right. back. And there was no way of knowing what you were doing while you were gone. There was no way of knowing when you were going to come back, if you were able to come back. So this is a kind of a big separation that we're talking about here. It's not simply like, you know, text me when you get there. So the understatedness of it in some ways is oddly emotionally affecting.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the meter also, just because, sure. So it's, yeah, it's iambic tetrameter, tetrameter, I don't know. But there's several points where he skips out of it just a little bit. And I found that very effective because it's like, this is a pretty simple metrical scheme, like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But then there's just a couple of points, like no more than one per verse usually, where he'll break it just a little bit. So, like, thy soul, the fixed foot, makes no show to move, but doth if the other do. Like, if the other is short, short, long. What's another one? A breach, but an expansion, like gold to airy thinness beat. At the end of expansion, it's missing a long. And I find that when you're reading this and paying attention to the meter, those places where it skips, it kind of gives them this extra emphasis where you pay attention to it more than if it was just like perfectly metered. And I really, really liked that. And that's one of the reasons why, like in retrospect, so it turns out that, apparently one of the reasons these guys were sort of reassessed was because T.S. Eliot, was a big booster of them, of the metaphysical poets. And I was pleased to see that because he's another one of my favorite poets because he does similar stuff with meter. He'll play around with it and use sort of typical schemes, but then mess with them a little bit. And I just find that to be, that's one of my favorite things in poetry.
I love what you say about those moments where he knows to step outside of meter or to swap the stress. Those turns are incredibly gracious, and that's what makes this kind of metered poetry really pleasing to the ear. Whereas I think modern readers who listen to 19th century poems like Longfellow is probably the best example of this, where it just ploddingly follows the meter, you know, wherever it goes. And that's one of the reasons why I think modern poetry broke so heavily with meter. Right. It was like, this is just junk. It moves from metaphors of death to metaphors of alchemy. There's a line in here. And the only reason I know this is I actually remember seeing this note in my high school textbook when they say, so let us melt and make no noise, that's supposed to be, according to that editor, it was supposed to be a reference to the fact that pure gold doesn't sizzle when it melts. Now, I have not found this reference anywhere else. So I was starting to disbelieve it, like thinking, huh, maybe this was just made up. But later in the poem, he talks about the way that gold retains its qualities even when pounded mm-hmm. out, airy thin, and spread. So I thought, well, you know, it continues this kind of gold metaphor. All these strange comparisons are woven throughout. Mm-hmm. Dunn expects you to keep up, or at least he expects his wife to keep up, which I think in some ways is a lovely little kind of intellectual game between two smart people.
Yeah, and that was one of the other things that I was seeing, like what a conceit is and what the metaphysical poets are. It was this sort of like intellectual game playing sort of like oh yeah, this was another thing Samuel Johnson said. Their learning instructs and their subtlety surprises, but the reader commonly thinks his improvement dearly bought, which I think a lot of my old classmates would agree with. It's sort of, I guess it was seen as like, ooh, look how smart I am about alchemy and compasses, and which I would consider to be unfair, but I guess I can understand why someone else would think that.
I think it's also instructional that's what Samuel Johnson thinks. Maybe someday we can do a podcast on Samuel Johnson. I think that's going to be a hard sell. maybe could read his dictionary or something. I guess we should end with this compass metaphor, because it is the single most famous, I think, metaphor in, unless you go back to like Shakespeare or something, or just comparing people to a summer's day, this is one of the most famous metaphors in all of English literature, the metaphor of two lovers as twin points of a compass. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that in your class, people didn't quite know what that was.
Yeah, well, some people did. I think I seem to remember that there was a little bit of, you know, grumbling, which I sort of got, so the woman is like the steady one that has to hold the man, like, to his, you know, which, you know, apart from the context of the time, it's just sort of like an annoying concept, but it makes perfect sense in the context of this specific poem, because we know that the speaker is leaving.
Yeah, I've heard that too. It might be a fair assessment if we're trying to apply this more universally, but it is a very particular poem, mm-hmm. between two particular people. The other thing, though, that universalizes this for me is the compass is also a kind of a classical illusion. There was an obsession in ancient Greek geometry with the idea that the only things that you could prove were the things that you could prove using a straight edge and a compass. They weren't interested in measuring anything. So people were very excited, for example, that if you know how to do it, you can bisect an angle using a compass and a straight edge. But there were a lot, they spent years and years trying to figure out whether or not they could trisect an angle with a compass. And I don't remember whether they ever figured it out or not. You know, modern readers would say, what's the deal? Why don't you just use a protractor or something like that? But this kind of obsession with geometrical beauty and purity, it marks, you know, something classical, and that is a highly metaphysical part of this poem in a way, that the love that these two people share is not simply something interior to them, but is also an expression of cosmic truth in a way. But maybe that's just me pushing this.
Oh no, because they explicitly talk about cosmic stuff earlier in the poem with the, you know, trepidation of the spheres.
Right.
Their love is not like some sort of lame earthquake. It's like the beautiful movement of the planets.
Yeah, the trepidation of the spheres is a reference to Ptolemy's model of the geocentric solar system. So go look it up, kids. Okay, let's move on to the second of these poems. Now, this one by Andrew Marvel, To His Coy Mistress, was written sometime probably during the Civil War. It wasn't published until after Marvel's death, and it was published by his housekeeper, who may have been his common law wife, and this poem might never have been published if it hadn't been for this woman saving it. You know, it reminds me very much of Emily Dickinson's poems that were not published in her lifetime at all, found in a box under her bed, and then today are central to the American canon. So here is To His Coy Mistress.
Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou by the Indian Ganges side shouldst rubies find. I by the tide of Humber would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song, then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity. and your quaint honor turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now, therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run.
In spite of being a much anthologized poem, this is one of the most highly anthologized poems going. It's a funny poem to teach to high schoolers because it's really about a guy trying to get into this woman's pants, but it is wry and funny. And I think these days it gets seen as a little bit creepy or like he's really trying to press someone who might be reluctant into but I think that there's a lot of clues in this poem that it is not necessarily Marvel, but Marvel putting on a voice. And I think the strongest clue is just the title, "To His Coy Mistress." It's not "To My Coy Mistress" or "To a Coy Mistress." It's we're setting up a kind of a voice here that I don't think we're as sophisticated readers supposed to see as being Marvel. We're trying to see it as a character playing a role. And that kind of slipperiness and sardonicness is what marks this to me as the beginning of a new kind of poetry that will become very popular in the 19th century. The you know, you think about people like Browning that basically did these little dramatic pieces that are not Browning. There's some other character talking.
It's not an unfair thing to say and probably should be said when this poem is being studied, but it's also not the end of the story, I guess. And so I think it's important to just sort of like take that and consider it, but then look at it like on its own merits, like A, in the context of the time, and B, sort of giving either the author or the narrator, like, sort of the benefit of the doubt that he's correct about this woman being coy and not actually uninterested. Like, coy is sort of a flirtatious lack of, you know, giving in to this thing. And it was how courtship worked back then, from what I understand. So I think it's like, definitely that is a thing, and especially when this is taught to young people, it should be emphasized. But yeah, like, as in and of itself, like as a poem, I liked this quite a bit. I don't think I like it as much as A Valediction, just because there's something about the, like, the AABB rhyme scheme, like, that just is a little bit, I don't know, I couldn't get into it as much, like, as a text. But the conceit of it, I kind of dig. Like, you know, if we had literally forever to love each other, I would spend, you know, thousands of years just on your one shoulder blade or whatever. But we can't because we're going to die, so let's get this going already. Like, I really like that, actually. That's kind of beautiful. Like, it's like, I love you so much that I just can't wait to get this thing going.
This poem has some amazing metaphors and some amazing lines. You mentioned you hadn't read this before, but you were familiar with several of the quotations.
So definitely, world enough and time, and vaster than empires and more slow. I think I've heard those both as like used as titles for short stories or in some other context, and they're both, you know, amazing turns of phrase.
Yeah, I think both of those were used as either the story titles or novels. I know that Fine in Private Place was used as a novel title. There's just so many lines in here. The Time's Winged Chariot, while it, right now it seems like such a cliche, I believe this was the first place that those three words were put together. Thus, though we cannot make our son stand still, yet we shall make him run. Part of what I like about it, though, is I do like this crazy, slippery narrative voice, and it makes me wonder very much about what the relationship is that actually is being tried here. As you mentioned, coy doesn't necessarily mean that she is being seduced against her will. It could mean that she is trying to put up what is considered a proper amount of resistance. And while today that's, I think people have little patience with that, it's useful to approach it in the context that it's meant. But you do wonder about this woman, because he's flattering to her, and at other turns he's kind of aggressive and snarky with her. We're told that they're going to wait forever. She's going to wait by the Ganges, you know, which is this exotic, faraway land of India. Now we could also talk about Orientalism and the othering there, but he's going to stay by the Humber, which is a northern English river that's kind of like really, really boring. It's like saying I'll wait by the Monongahela or something like that. And so there's this way that he's trying to play up her beauty, but then the lines about her being in the grave and worms trying her virginity.
That part was kind of gross.
Yeah,
it was pretty... But I suppose it's meant to be gross. At least an arresting image.
It's arresting because it makes so physical what is being talked about in sort of a oblique way. You know, if we're going to talk about the physicality of virginity and the physicality of being eaten by worms, it's like, well, one way or another, someone's going to have that. You can be irritated with this speaker. You can be angry with the speaker. Mallory Ortberg of the Beloved Toast wrote a very funny reply, basically telling him off. But this poem itself has been responded to by poets, I think, since the time it was written. People have written response poems. You can look them up. But I feel like it carries its own criticisms inside itself in a way. I'm trying to rescue it from just being a creepy poem, but
It's the baby it's cold outside of metaphysical poetry.
Right.
There's just a couple more lines that I really liked in here. The one about like amorous birds of prey. I don't know how much Planet Earth you watch, but I watch a lot of it. And when birds of prey are mating, they'll like be way high up in the sky and like grab their talons together and sort of cartwheel down through the air. And it's this really beautiful kind of terrifying thing to watch, because it looks like they're about to plummet to the earth and die. Like, that's a perfect image to use in this poem.
The 17th century is divided between traditionally between the metaphysical poets and the cavalier poets. And the connection here is in some ways, while it's in some ways stylistic, it's also political. The metaphysical poets tended, Marvel especially, allied themselves with the Republican movement in the 17th century, whereas the Cavaliers were the monarchists. And the Cavalier poems, we're not going to do any of them, but if you're interested, you can look up the Cavalier poets. They were the old guard, and their poems were light and fluffy, and the whole idea of writing them was that you were supposed to write something that sounded like it had just been came off the top of your head and dwelt on the happy side of life, whereas metaphysical poets were very dark and somber. And what I find fascinating about all this is this was basically a political argument that was being carried out in the realm of poetry. And so we've had culture wars since this time.
Well, it's really interesting that you say that, because you also said that these guys weren't recognized as a distinct school at their time.
Right.
So that means that there was like the sensibility of being a monarchist or not was like leaking into their poetry in ways that weren't even like noticed until later. That's really cool.
The other thing that I think is worth mentioning here, because I don't know where else I will, is that it was a Cavalier poet by the name of John Suckling who invented the game of cribbage. So if you ever play cribbage, you can thank
John Suckling. I certainly have not.
I chose these two because they're very famous poems and because they were the ones that I was taught when I was in high school. It might be oversimplifying things to try to draw large conclusions from one poem by each of two poets, but how do you think about metaphysical poetry now that you've listened to these two or read these two?
Well, I have to admit that I have sort of cheated by, when I was doing the research for this, looking up an essay that T.S. Eliot wrote about the metaphysical poets. And I thought it was all so bang on that maybe I shouldn't have read it because now I like kind of agree with all the points that he made there. But I can just quote like the relevant part of that and talk a little bit about it.
Sure.
Okay, so Tennyson and Browning are poets and they think, but they do not feel their thoughts as immediately as the odor of a rose. A thought to Donne was an experience. It modified his sensibility. When a poet's mind is perfectly equipped for its work, it is constantly amalgamating disparate experiences. An ordinary man falls in love or reads Spinoza, and these two experiences have nothing to do with each other. So I just really like that idea that these men were constantly looking to combine their experiences in ways that like could make sense to themselves, and using that as a way of understanding the world as a whole. And to get a little bit like weird, and that's kind of how I approach a lot of my writing and art. By combining disparate elements. I just really like that idea of them looking at everything that they could see in the world and trying to draw these comparisons between them and using that as their tool for, you know, examining their own feelings. It's great. So I dig it.
I love that, what you just said there, but I'm going to back up to something you mentioned earlier, which is you talk about how reading T.S. Eliot's essay has colored your ideas about this. And it's an argument that people have all the time about art and literature is how much context we need to give for anything. And as you mentioned, there are modern schools of thoughts that really try to remove the work from the context of its creation and are much more interested in the work in the context of its dissemination or of its use. And as a kid, I was really, really interested in learning more about these things that were out there in the world and why they were there. And it obviously stuck with me over the years in a deep way to learn a bit of the context about the way these poems were made, to the point that I just can't imagine talking about them outside of that context. But you read the To His Coy Mistress fresh, right? You read it before you read anything else. And
yes.
And what was that experience like?
I was sort of approaching, like, so there were different, like, there's, as a poem, like, just with the rhyme and meter, like, the structure of it, you know, apart from the content. And then there was the way that the language is presented, like, within each sentence. And then there are the overall concepts that are being explored. And so I was just sort of thinking like, okay, really like this concept, not a huge fan of the rhyme scheme. Some of these turns of phrase are really beautiful. Like that's sort of how I approached it before I had any of this other context.
Yeah.
Just like as a piece of art. And I think that that is like a valid thing. Like the thing that bothers me about when people get like super into Death of the Author is I think that is a valid way of approaching a work, but it isn't sufficient. I think you have to do both, because otherwise you can't get a full picture of what's going on. My favorite, so I said I did Valediction in my class where I had a teacher who was like really into Death of the Author. And I just remember the previous year when I had a totally different, type of teacher, we were reading Pablo Neruda, and right at the beginning of one of the poems, she said, "All right, listen, this poem is not about vampires. Every single year somebody tries to tell me it's about vampires, and I'm just going to tell you right now, it's not. It's about the moon. Okay, go. And I was like, thank you. That's great. This is... I feel like that is an appropriate approach. Shout out to Ms. Joplin.
Thanks to my co-host, Liz Regal. Thanks to my poetry reader, David Lohr. You can hear his work on the Incomparable Radio Theater. Thanks to my network, The Incomparable. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Mostly thanks to you, listener, for listening. You can join the discussion on the Facebook page or write to me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.